Good afternoon from New York. My name is Rekha Rangachari, NIAC's Executive Director, and I'm delighted to offer you various programs during these times of pandemic. Today, we are in the final session of our Spotlight on Life Sciences Disputes. We're looking generally today at best practices when drafting dispute resolution clauses. We'll discuss collaboration agreements and exclusions, ways to carve out protections. We'll spotlight distinct realities of IP and patent disputes, and we'll identify key procedural rules and considerations. With an eye to the clock, we hope to venture also into this topic of covered or protected investments within investment treaties relevant to life sciences investors. Our topical leaders today are those known to you: Preeti Bagnani, partner in the New York office of White & Case, a NIAC founding firm, and Rachel Thorne, partner in the New York office of Cooley. For both Preeti and Rachel, their practice focuses on international commercial arbitration, investment treaty disputes, and international litigation. During our brief time together, I'll introduce the topic and cede the floor to our panelists. Two administrative items. First, to encourage engagement, we invite you to posit your questions into the chat feature. We'll take these either live during the section as apropos or at its culmination. And second, this session is being recorded and will soon post to the NIAC audio library. With that, let's begin. We're talking first about dispute resolution clauses, their scope, their exclusions, and the like. And so I'm going to hand the floor over to Preeti to take us through this introductory reality, collaboration agreements, delegation, IP, patent disputes, and the like. Preeti, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rekha. Hi, everyone. We thought we'd start with dispute resolution clauses, their scope and exclusions, because that's an area that we find where we find disputes often arise in connection with the actual formulation of a dispute resolution clause. In agreements in the life sciences sector, and particularly R&D collaboration and license agreements, we frequently see complex dispute resolution clauses. Sometimes we have provisions that designate certain disputes for decision through internal dispute resolution procedures, for example, decision by a joint steering committee established for the collaboration. And then if there is a deadlock at that level, it escalates up sometimes to the party's executives. And often clauses provide for further escalation of deadlocked disputes for external resolution, either to expert determination, mediation, arbitration, litigation, or some combination of those procedures. We also find that there are provisions sometimes that expressly exclude or carve out certain disputes from arbitration, most often patent and antitrust disputes. These complex provisions, if not carefully drafted, could lead to or exacerbate disputes about the scope of a clause, the scope of a dispute, the proper forum for resolving it, and whether a court or arbitrator should decide even the threshold question of whether a dispute falls within or outside a carve-out. That can lead to parallel arbitration and litigation proceedings, inconsistent decisions, which of course adds time and cost to resolving disputes. Rachel and I will spend some time discussing the types of carve-outs from the main dispute resolution clause that we frequently see in life science collaborations and some pitfalls to avoid. I'll focus first on expert determination carve-outs and patent carve-outs for patent disputes. Rachel will then talk about carve-outs for equitable remedies and the delegation of disputes for resolution by joint steering committees. So let's turn first to expert determination. What is it? How does it differ from arbitration? And what are some key factors to consider when drafting an expert determination clause? Expert determination is essentially where the parties grant limited authority to an expert to use specialized, his or her specialized knowledge to decide a specific factual dispute concerning a matter within that expert's special expertise. It's most often used to determine discrete technical or valuation issues. For example, in the life sciences context, an expert could be appointed to determine whether or not a particular milestone has been achieved. The valuation of an intellectual property asset, or the establishment of royalty rates. And a key advantage of expert determination, as opposed to litigation or arbitration, is that for purely technical or valuation disputes, it can be a more cost-effective way of resolving the dispute. But there are some key differences between expert determination and arbitration that I think are important to be aware of. One is that unlike an arbitration, which ordinarily encompasses the resolution of the entire legal controversy between the parties, an expert determination is limited to the resolution of specific disputed issues of fact. So it's a resolution of a discrete issue of fact, as opposed to what might be a much broader dispute that could resolve all of the issues between the parties. Second, experts are not required to decide the dispute only on the evidence submitted to them by the parties. Rather, they're expected to act on the basis of their own special knowledge and expertise. And third, there's no direct means of enforcing an expert decision abroad in the manner that you might enforce a court judgment or an arbitral award. Ordinarily, if a party refuses to comply with an expert's decision, to enforce it, you would need to commence a new action, and it would be enforceable almost as a contract. And fourth, there are differences in the standard for review. Review of an arbitral award, as many listeners will know, in the US at least, is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, where it's an international arbitration. Courts will not review an arbitral award on the grounds that an arbitrator may have committed an error of law or a mistake of fact. Expert determinations are governed by state law, not the FAA. And the standard under New York law, for example, which is similar to the law of many other states, is that such determinations will be binding on the parties except where there is fraud, bad faith, or culpable mistake. So those are some of the key differences to be aware of at the outset. Some factors to consider when drafting an expert determination clause. One is typically parties want an expert determination to be binding. So it's important to expressly provide in the clause that the expert's decision will be final and binding, and to identify explicitly any exceptions. Some of the common exceptions that we frequently see are fraud or manifest error. A second tip is be very clear about which disputes are to be dealt with by the expert and which disputes are to go directly before an arbitral tribunal or a national court. That will reduce the risk that a party can stall the dispute resolution process by seeking a preliminary determination as to the scope of an expert's jurisdiction. A third point to bear in mind is it's often difficult for parties to reach agreement on the identity of an expert. So the expert determination clause should provide that if parties cannot agree on the identity of the expert, a specified body known as the appointing authority will identify a suitable candidate on the application of either party. If there's no such provision, the court will not have power to appoint the expert, which may frustrate the party's intent to have those specific issues determined by expert determination. The best practice is to check with the appointing authority at the time when you start drafting the expert determination clause to confirm that it will be in a position to act as appointing authority when called upon to do so. A further consideration is to think about what mechanism you will provide to deal with challenges to the expert's decision, whether it's litigation or arbitration. You want to avoid a situation in which it's unclear which forum a party would go to if a party considers that the decision is not final and binding or refuses to comply with the decision, because that in lack of clarity will only lead to additional time and costs for both sides. And finally, you want to think about expressly stating in the clause that the expert has a duty to act independently. So those are some of the key considerations, I think, that are worth bearing in mind when drafting and negotiating an expert termination clause. I want to turn to patent disputes, because issues of patent infringement and validity come up quite often in life science collaborations and licensing agreements. And it's quite common to see clauses providing for all disputes to be arbitrated except for disputes relating to the scope, validity, or enforceability, or infringement of patents. Many of the time, those types of disputes will be expressly carved out and assigned to litigation. So I want to address two issues in turn. First, when should parties consider excluding patent disputes from arbitration? What are the benefits and what are the risks? And second, assuming the parties wish to carve out patent disputes, what are some considerations, again, to bear in mind in drafting such a carve out? I think the circumstance in which it often makes sense to exclude patent disputes from arbitration is where your arbitration is seated in a jurisdiction where those patent disputes are not arbitrable. There are a few jurisdictions that do not permit arbitration of disputes concerning patent invalidity. For example, I believe invalidity claims are not arbitrable in China, Brazil, or Finland. Arbitrating a patent dispute in one of those jurisdictions could result in the award being set aside at the seat, which of course would lead to difficulties enforcing the award in various other jurisdictions, including the US. So at the outset, you'll want to investigate the seat of the arbitration and consider whether patent disputes, assuming you consider that they're likely to arise, are arbitrable. So that's a scenario where it might make sense to carve out disputes regarding validity or infringement of a patent. There are other reasons that parties sometimes choose to exclude patent disputes, although in my view, these often can be addressed with carefully crafted arbitration clauses. For example, it's sometimes raised that arbitrators may not be well versed in patent law, but that can be addressed by specifically providing for certain qualifications when you draft the arbitration clause to ensure the appointment of arbitrators with the appropriate background and experience. Another factor that's often raised is that a tribunal might not institute the patent-specific procedures that many patent lawyers believe are appropriate in a patent dispute. Again, I think that's something that could be addressed by adopting patent-specific arbitration rules like WIPO arbitration rules or the AAA's supplementary rules. Sometimes parties get jittery about the thought of the absence of any appeal, especially where their main asset, or sometimes their only asset, is the IP that's at issue in a prospective dispute. Again, that can be addressed by adopting arbitral rules that provide for appeals by appellate arbitrators. So I think the most compelling reason to me to carve out patent disputes remains the question of arbitrability. Now, carving out patent disputes from the main dispute resolution clause involves some risk. Disputes typically involve different aspects of a contractual relationship, many of which are interconnected. A common scenario is where a licensor terminates a license agreement for alleged infringement, files an infringement claim against the terminated licensee, and the licensee believes that the license was improperly terminated and it continues to have a license. If issues of infringement are carved out from the arbitration clause, then the licensee's defense, which is that it wasn't infringing the license, can only be heard in court, even though it may be a defense to the termination claim that would otherwise be heard in arbitration. So you end up with parallel proceedings, additional cost, time, and the risk of inconsistent outcomes. The key takeaway here is just consider carefully whether it's truly necessary to carve out patent disputes from the arbitration clause. Now, if a party does want to exclude patent disputes, there are a couple of important factors to consider in drafting the clause. One is to be very clear about the types of disputes that you're excluding, and as explicit as possible about the context in which those claims should be excluded. One example, a case example that comes up is Veraneta Health against Ariosa Diagnostics, a 2016 case, where the party's agreement quite expressly stated that the arbitration clause shall not apply to disputes relating to issues of scope, infringement, validity, and or enforceability of any intellectual property rights. Now, despite that arguably very clear language, when the patentee was sued for infringement in federal court, the patentee tried to compel arbitration of its counterclaim for non-infringement. And that led to a court battle about scope, which ended up costing the parties time and expense. So the lesson here is to be as specific as you possibly can. One suggestion might be to specify even further that patent-related claims are not arbitrable in any context, whether raised as a claim, a defense, a counterclaim, or when affirmatively raised by the claimant. Another suggestion is to consider including a provision that expressly designates who, whether it's the arbitrators or the court, is to decide the preliminary issue of whether a particular dispute falls within or outside the carve-out, the so-called gateway question. Because courts have again arrived at quite inconsistent outcomes on this question. As many of you will know, in the Archer and White against Henry Schein case, the Fifth Circuit decided that it was the court and not the arbitrators that had the authority to determine whether the claims fell within the carve-out. And that case has now gone up to the Supreme Court for the second time. The court heard oral argument on it yesterday. Rachel might speak a little bit more about this case as she discusses carve-outs for equitable remedies. So I'm going to pause there. I'm going to cede the floor to Rachel to discuss equitable remedy carve-outs and delegation of disputes to joint steering committees.
Thank you. I guess one other thought I would have on I'm thinking about carving out IP disputes is also thinking about before I transition, but it occurred to me as Preeti was talking that where you're going to enforce the award is also important, because even if an IP dispute is arbitrable at the seat, of course, if you're looking to enforce the award against a Chinese counterparty in China, you may not be much more advanced than you were if you would have carved it out and chosen something else. So it's just something to think about. It's a complicated issue. Looking at the equitable remedy, so obviously in IP agreements, as in many agreements, there's oftentimes a feeling that you need to protect the ability to go to court to enjoin some sort of offending conduct in IP agreements frequently, right? It could be something like preventing your counterparty from using your IP in breach of the agreement, or from disclosing your IP and preserving a trade secret or something like that, or removing an infringing good from the market. Oftentimes, equitable remedies are really important in all sorts of IP, what we'll call IP agreements. And it's common to carve out equitable remedies. I think the issue there is, and what we see frequently is sometimes you'll carve out an interim remedy, or you'll make an express provision for an interim remedy, and sometimes it goes beyond equitable remedies. I mean, interim remedies into more permanent injunctive relief. So, most institutional rules will provide for joint power for the tribunal and for the courts to issue interim remedies. So let's start with that. And where they may differ and why it's always good to go and look at the rules is when the jurisdiction of the tribunal begins and ends, and where the jurisdiction of the courts begin and end. And so some rules will say that the parties can get interim remedies at any point up until constitution of the tribunal, and then constrain the power of the parties to go to court thereafter. Others are more free form. The tip here is take a look at your institutional rules and make sure that you understand how they work, and make any adjustments that you think are necessary for interim remedies. Now, coming to the question of more permanent equitable relief, frequently where we see it is in the context of non-competes and confidentiality clauses, which are actually carved out of arbitration, and the parties agree that their remedies will be in court. Oftentimes, they'll specify a specific court with exclusive or non-exclusive jurisdiction. And I think here it's important to take a step back and ask what the business objectives are for that carve out, and whether having a complete carve out for permanent injunctive relief, either for all equitable remedies or for equitable remedies for certain breaches, is necessary or a good idea, and whether we're not just setting up a Henry Schein situation, and Henry Schein is certainly not the only situation, but we're setting up a situation where the parties are going to find themselves mired in court on a gateway issue for years while the merits stay undecided. And oftentimes what we find when we talk to clients is that there isn't a compelling need to carve out permanent equitable relief, and that the issues that it raises really don't justify doing it. So, right, in addition to basic questions like who's going to decide what the impact is of an equitable carve out, is it going to be the courts? Is it going to be the arbitrator? I think judging by some of the colloquy yesterday and the questioning by the court, it sounds like it may be that we have an answer to that question, at least in the United States, coming up. But there's other questions about what are the interplays between two different court cases, a court case and an arbitration case. Can they proceed in parallel? Can they, does one pace the other? Who decides what the order is going to be? And maybe it's easier, you say, where there's just a carve out for certain types of disputes, but you're still in a context where there's parallel proceedings, higher court costs, higher litigation costs, and a possibility for inconsistent outcomes. And you're giving a tool to the counterparty to be recalcitrant and drive up costs and affect, you know, the progress of the dispute. So in most cases, you know, I think where once we've talked this through with clients, where they land is that the potential complications, the potential costs don't justify having a carve out for permanent equitable relief. And, you know, even for discrete portions of breaches and things like that. So that's that issue. Another thing that we frequently see, and I see this more in collaboration and joint development agreements, is certain types of disputes get carved out of even regular, what I'll say is regular institutional arbitration or even ad hoc arbitration, and put into a stylized form of baseball arbitration, where really the intent is to avoid an unenforceable agreement to agree. So where does this come up? Well, like in a collaboration agreement, where it comes up is that two parties have come together, they both have IP, maybe one is bringing some more money to the table so that they can develop a product. And there may be different uses of that IP that one party might want to take forward and use in a different application, but another party doesn't. And the parties can envision that dispute as existing, but it's not worth their time today to figure out the future terms of a licensing deal or a royalty rate. And so what they agree is they set up a construct where they identify the type of dispute. And what they say is it will go to quote unquote baseball arbitration to decide the terms of that future licensing deal or the terms of the royalty rate and what it's going to be, rather than going to a more fulsome arbitration process. And the idea there is that, and normally how it's set up is that both sides will come to the decision maker, the arbitrator, with term sheets and proposals, and they'll justify it. And the decision-making authority of the arbitrator is constrained to choose one, to choose either party A's or party B's, or maybe it's to choose in more of a menu approach, certain terms from one sheet and certain terms from another sheet, and then that becomes the award. And then both sides agree that that will be final and binding and maybe specifically enforced, which is an innovative way, I think, to solve that and to get around some of the transaction costs associated with, you know, trying to figure out all of the different possibilities on day one when the dispute, you know, may never come up or may come up years and years down the road in the collaboration. And so rather than spending time negotiating around, say, a hypothetical product, they do that. The tips here are, if you are going to do that, be very, very express. I think the word of today's presentation is less ambiguity, more clarity, and thinking things through in terms of drafting and being as express as you can. So being clear about what the process is going to be and thinking about the process in a way that works for both sides and gives both sides the opportunity to really engage. So frequently what we'll recommend is a situation where both sides have an opportunity to put competing term sheets in. They have an opportunity to respond to the other's term sheets. And then following some sort of a hearing, they'll have an opportunity to adjust or amend their positions if they change, and present it to the arbitrator. And then, as I said, the arbitrator will issue an award. Make sure if you are using rules that the institutional rules are consistent with what the dispute resolution process is. So for example, you know, it may not work to have an ICC arbitration clause if you're doing this from a scrutiny process with the ICC court or from, you know, the delays that might be inherent in that. It might be better to choose a different set of rules. Frequently, these are ad hoc. So then you get into a question of appointing authority and making sure that one is specified. And there the concern would be, as Preeti was talking about with the expert determinations, you know, what happens if the parties can't agree on either the chair or on a sole arbitrator, or one party refuses to appoint somebody? And so where do you go to get a tribunal constituted? So if you are ad hoc, make sure there's an appointing authority or you're going to end up being in court. And I know certainly with COVID, there were a lot of parties that were really trying to avoid having to go to court in similar situations because the courts were either not open for business or were very slow to come to be able to appoint anybody. So that's not a happy situation. And then, you know, make sure that the award, you specify that it's final and binding, and that, you know, judgment may be entered and that it may be specifically enforced in order to address that kind of you know, any collateral challenges after the fact, and again, to really effectuate the party's intent. So another type of carve out that we see, and again, it's frequently in collaboration agreements or joint venture agreements, is, you know, what do you do with the joint operating committee or the joint steering committee, and sort of the way that the parties are going to manage their relationships and make decisions about what the joint venture is going to do or what the collaboration is going to do. And so frequently what we see there is that there will be a creation of a committee, whatever you want to call it. And then there's a delegation of certain disputes to that committee. And then there is a, there's usually a discussion within the contract. There's a provision that addresses what is the decision-making authority of that committee, oftentimes leaving out, well, what happens if they can't decide, or is there any recourse if a party doesn't like the decision? So first things we would say is be very clear on what the responsibility of that committee is, what they can and can't do, whether they combine parties, the extent to which they combine parties, and be very clear on the decision-making authority. What can they decide if there is a dispute and the parties don't agree? Frequently, what will end up happening is that the parties agree upfront that on certain issues or certain types of decisions, if the JSC or the JOC can't decide, it'll go to a party, and that party has final decision-making authority. Certain other types of disputes will go to the other party, and they will have final decision-making authority. Sometimes we see if the JSC can't agree, then the decision simply isn't taken and no action's taken. So that needs to be expressed. And then we need to think about if there should be any constraints on that decision-making authority. So for example, if certain types of disputes are delegated to one party, does that party have unfettered discretion to make whatever decision they want? Or is it constrained by they can't make material changes in the scope of a phase, or they can't make material changes on the scope of activities or the cost of those activities? And then the question becomes, well, if you are going to constrain that decision-making authority, then who decides if they breached it? And so oftentimes, you know, you need to think about, well, are you going to send it to arbitration? And if so, perhaps consider making that express. Because if there's a straight carve out from arbitration, it may be in a situation where it's unclear where a party would go if they think their counterparty has made a decision in breach of the constraints and abused their discretion. And so you need to be clear about that. So I'll pause there. I don't know, Preeti, if you have any thoughts on that before we turn to ad hoc versus institutional.
No, I don't. Thank you, Rachel.
Okay, so let's go to our next bucket. We're mindful of time. Our hope to you, the delegates, is to talk about institutional procedural considerations and make it to a brief conversation as well about investor considerations in the ISDS realm. So let's go to institutional rules. Rachel, if you could keep that mic and take us through what are considerations here as we look to between institutions and offerings, procedural considerations and beyond.
So frequently one of the things that we see is our parties, I think, really responding to what they view are perhaps limitations of institutional rules and pulling on and really celebrating, I think, the flexibility and sort of the blank slate that arbitration can give you to develop elaborate arbitration schedules or ADR schedules or things like that, and moving away from institutional rules. So I come at it from a perspective of seeing both in play. So when we say institutional rules, obviously we're talking about the different arbitration institutions and the fact that they've developed these rules and they've developed these rules mindful of the ways arbitrations might go off track and in response to end user and sort of the broader community's response to the rules and what works and what doesn't and what innovations need to happen, all of which sort of you give up when you choose an ad hoc arbitration. So what am I talking about? You might be talking about emergency arbitrator relief. You might be talking about appointing authorities. You might be talking about certain provisions on confidentiality or certain things with discovery. There's all sorts of a host of things, timing considerations. So there's all sorts of things that come into institutional rules that I think make them attractive, including things also like fee schedules, having somebody else perhaps deal with some of the administrative and less comfortable conversations about how much people charge for their services, all of that, role of experts. So all of that's built up in institutional rules. As I said, I think the benefit of ad hoc arbitration for people who really press for it is a sense that maybe the institutions are expensive and that they're not worth it, that they're slower, and that they can do a better job of crafting a process that will really work for them and their types of disputes. And as much as I appreciate that sentiment, I think, you know, you throw the baby out with the bathwater on that. And unless you're being very comprehensive in how you draft that ad hoc schedule, you're leaving a lot of things on the table. And, you know, what are you leaving on the table? Well, the first and foremost, perhaps, is the appointing authority. Oftentimes, the schedules don't contain an appointing authority. And I don't think people necessarily, you know, think about the fact that they may not agree on a decision maker. You might be leaving on the table things like, where do you go if you want to challenge an arbitrator in an ad hoc arbitration? In some jurisdictions, there's no pre-award challenge to the partiality of an arbitrator. And in some jurisdictions, there's also no affirmative duty to disclose. And so you open yourself up all on that, whereas in an institutional setting, there's an ability there to, you know, not only will there be standards of disclosure, but there's an institution sitting behind it that can help resolve pre-award challenges to arbitrators and questions that are being raised. So that's another big benefit I see of institutional rules. I think that the things that end up being crafted in bespoke arbitration clauses can be put in an institutional clause. So again, you know, the world is the party's oyster in terms of what they're looking for. Frequently, there's going to be provisions about timing. Sometimes that timing is extremely fast track and not necessarily realistic. Sometimes there'll be, you know, even constraints on the number of hearing days and things like that, which, you know, we usually say, if you're going to do that because you want to impress upon the decision maker that the parties want to move very quickly, make sure you have a backstop, because not all disputes can be resolved in a single day of hearings, for example. Also thinking about things like confidentiality and multi-party arbitration. Different institutional rules take different approaches. But if you think there's going to be a situation where you will want Marty, you know, to join other parties, you're better off choosing institutional rules that envisage that possibility and permit it. And so that's also something else to think about in terms of institutional rules versus ad hoc rules. I think those are, from my perspective, some of the main things that we think about. And then obviously all institutional rules are different. And so one shouldn't assume that you can pluck an arbitration clause from one contract and swap out ICDR for ICC or HKIAC for, you know, LCIA or something like that without going through and seeing how the different rules treat different issues like default appointments, default to sole, you know, emergency arbitrator relief and all that kind of thing, because there are differences among the rules. And, you know, again, the parties may not get what they thought that they were getting when there's that kind of approach taken to drafting.
Thanks so much, Rachel. Let's move it then to Preeti to comment, I think, back on that. And then also to take us into some considerations of confidentiality, as well as expedited or fast track arbitration. We're seeing this increasingly in revised arbitral institutional rules. And onwards, Preeti, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Rick. I was just gonna comment on one of the factors that will affect your choice of institutional rules is confidentiality. Especially important in the life sciences space, where many disputes relate to know-how and trade secrets, and where the mere disclosure of IP or an IP dispute could cause substantial commercial harm to a party. There's no clear duty of confidentiality imposed on parties to arbitration proceedings in the US. If you were in a different jurisdiction, it might be different. For example, Singapore common law recognizes an implied duty of confidentiality in an arbitration. But in light of that, to secure confidentiality, parties have two options. They can either provide for it in their arbitration agreement or choose arbitral rules that call for confidentiality. And if you go with the route of choosing institutional rules, then it's important to be aware of the differences between them as to confidentiality. All the major institutional rules impose a duty of confidentiality on the arbitrators, but they differ regarding the duties on the parties. So, for example, the ICC rules don't say anything about confidentiality on part of the parties. The WIPO rules impose the most extensive and sophisticated confidentiality provisions on parties. And other rule institutions like the ICDR and the LCIA rules do include provisions on confidentiality, although there are some differences between them. ICDR, for example, will prevent disclosure of confidential information during the proceedings. And the LCIA rules are similar, although the most recent version of the LCIA rules in 2020 goes further and even requires the parties to obtain an undertaking of confidentiality from all of the stakeholders involved, including witnesses, experts, and service providers. So it can make a difference. I think the final point on confidentiality is bear in mind that despite, you know, parties' efforts to institute confidentiality during the arbitration, they may lose their right to maintain the award's confidentiality if either party goes to court and seeks intervention, either by applying to confirm or vacate the award. Most courts will find that there is a public interest in disclosure of the award. And in order to maintain that confidentiality, if you were applying to court to confirm or vacate, very often a party would need to show that the documents or the specific documents in question deserve some long-term confidential treatment, for example, because they contain trade secrets. So it's an important issue, particularly, I think, in the life sciences sector, and one that can make a difference in your choice of procedural rules. I'm conscious that it's 12:42. Rather than dive into fast-track proceedings, I wonder if we should jump right into the final topic, which is investment treaties. I'm in your hands, Rita. What do you think?
I think let's jump into investment treaty protections, you know, a newer topic, and hopefully engaging these delegates. Thanks so much.
Okay, so I'll spend just a bit of time. I don't think we have enough time to get into the details, but just to kind of map out the landscape. As many listeners will know, there's a wide network of some 3,000 plus investment treaties investment chapters of FTAs that provide protections to foreign investors, including in the life sciences sector. To date, there have been approximately, I think, 10 publicly reported claims brought by investors in the life sciences sector challenging various governmental measures. I think our listeners will generally be aware that to bring a claim under an investment treaty, the claimant needs to demonstrate that it is an investor as defined under the investment treaty and has made an investment also as defined in the treaty. The term investment is often broadly defined as every kind of asset having an economic value. Often that's accompanied by an illustrative list of assets that qualify as investments. And the types of investments that have been found to qualify for protection include many of the types of investments that pharmaceutical companies, global pharmaceutical companies, make abroad. One example is marketing authorizations for the sale of patented medicines and intellectual property rights. And as to intellectual property rights specifically, we know that several treaties list IPRs specifically under the definition of investment. And we're starting to see confirmation in the jurisprudence that IPRs, trademarks, and patents qualify as covered investments. For example, just a few months ago, a tribunal issued an award in the Bridgestone against Panama case. The tribunal there concluded that while the mere act of registering a trademark alone will not constitute a covered investment, when that trademark owner exploits the mark by manufacturing and promoting products bearing the mark in the host country, that registered mark then does qualify as an investment. And that's because at that point, the trademark will bear the hallmarks of an investment in that it confers a benefit on the host state and it involves a risk on the part of the mark owner. The same goes for trademark license. The Bridgestone Tribunal found that a trademark license could qualify as an investment as long as the licensee exploited the mark through commercial activity in Panama. So I think we're likely to see an increase in pharmaceutical investors leveraging investment treaties, and particularly bringing claims in connection with intellectual property rights. Pharma companies have already challenged a host of government measures under investment treaties. Some are the typical measures that many foreign investors experience, while others are, I'd say, more likely to come up in the life sciences space. For example, in a case against Poland, Serbia against Poland, when health authorities in Poland failed to renew the authorization for medicines produced by the French pharmaceutical company Servier, while simultaneously granting authorization to Polish companies to produce generic alternatives of those medicines, the investor successfully challenged the denial of the authorization and secured damages for unlawful indirect expropriation. We've also seen claims for measures such as undue delays in lifting an import alert, invalidation of patents by domestic courts, the mishandling of disputes by domestic courts, and most recently a claim by Qatar Pharma against Saudi Arabia, where they alleged that because of the Saudi blockade of Qatar, it was forced to close warehouses and was unable to import raw materials that had previously come in through Saudi Arabia. Some of the claims that investors have brought over the years have led governments to revise or sometimes even withdraw proposed measures that were challenged. For example, when Gilead, the pharmaceutical company, challenged the registration by Ukraine of a generic version of its patented hepatitis C drug before the statutory exclusivity period had lapsed, as part of the settlement of that dispute with the government, we saw that the government deregistered the generic. So the bottom line for life science investors is that investment treaties can provide powerful protections, and investors have benefited from planning their investment to take advantage of those protections, either by structuring or restructuring, in certain cases, their investment through a state that has a favorable treaty with the host state in which an investment is being made. Some of the key questions that investors will want to consider when engaging in investment treaty planning is there a relevant investment treaty in place with the host state? What's the definition of a covered investor? Is there a requirement of a real presence in the home state? Does the treaty have a what's known as a denial of benefits clause? And that's a clause that we see under many treaties that permits the host state to deny the benefits of the treaty to the investor and the investment if the investor is owned or controlled by nationals of a third state and the investor has no substantial business activities in the territory of its home state. Another question is, of course, the definition of covered investment under the relevant treaty. Does it cover the investment that's at issue in your case? And does the treaty have the standard protections that we see in many treaties, like prohibition on unlawful expropriation, fair and equitable treatment, national treatment, and most favored nation treatment? So those are just some of the questions investors, I think, should consider at the outset of an investment to ensure that they can avail of the protections that may be available under investment treaties. I'll pause there and open it up to Rachel or Reka if you have any comments.
Rachel, I don't know if you have any comments to offer before we'll close out.
I don't. I thought that was a great summary, and it'll be interesting to see how that continues to develop, especially with some of, you know, the COVID vaccine and things like that, and whether that ends up generating some more disputes.
Indeed. Well, you know, in truth, it's a stay tuned on many things, but as you look to drafting, as Preeti and Rachel have pointed out, we have to be really circumspect about clarity and scope so that we can try to minimize some of these disputes as we go along. This is going to soon post to our audio library, but I wanted to add, if you have questions in particular about today's session, Preeti and Rachel are gracious enough, reach out to them directly. Their profiles are publicly available on their firm's website. As always, it has been a pleasure to beam into your homes, to have Rachel and Preeti with us guiding the way. And we look forward to meeting with you again soon to discuss this and other topics. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great day.